Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I suppose I just want to be, I just want to be successful. I just want to be, I just want to be successful. I just want to be, I just want to be successful.
Today, on The Brian Lehrer Show, a family meeting on making it. A family meeting on making it. What does it mean to be successful at different stages of life?
Then keep it a secret and watch me achieve it. Cause I know what I want now. If you want
a family meeting on making it. What does it mean to be successful at different stages of life? What does it mean, President Obama?
I know that when I am on my deathbed someday, I will not be thinking about any particular legislation I pass. I will not be thinking about a policy I promoted. I will not be thinking about the speech I gave. I will not be thinking about the Nobel Prize I received. I will be thinking about that walk I took with my daughters. I'll be thinking about a lazy afternoon with my wife. I'll be thinking about sitting around the dinner table and seeing them happy and healthy and knowing that they were loved. And I'll be thinking about whether I did right by all of them.
You won't be thinking at all about winning the Nobel Peace Prize, Barack Obama, or bringing health insurance to millions with Obamacare, really? Do we need to wipe out our achievements in the world so completely to prove we care about our families? Is there that much tension today between work and home, that much guilt? Maybe that's one of the things we'll talk about in this family meeting on making it. So what does it mean to you? Let's start with a simple fill-in-the-blank. Call in and fill-in-the-blank. I'll know I've made it when 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Fill in the blank. I'll know I've made it on this family meeting on making it when what? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, as your calls are coming in, we know that making it is different at different stages of life. This week, we asked a group of fourth graders from the Little Red Schoolhouse this.
What makes a successful 10-year-old?
What I think makes a successful 10-year-old is donating to help the world, I guess.
Don't try to copy anyone or what they're doing. Just be yourself and do what you want to do.
I just all of a sudden got really good at kicking a ball. Then I could feel successful about that.
Make a choice and stick to it if you really like it.
Well, it just matters what you think success is. Like, it's not how big or small it is, it's just what you think success is, and that's successful to you, I guess.
I think a successful 10-year-old is someone who accomplished all of their goals when they were 9.
A successful 10-year-old is someone who accomplished all their goals when they were 9. I love that last kid. Then nothing to look forward to for the next 90 or so years. But fourth graders from the Little Red Schoolhouse in Lower Manhattan on what it means to be a successful 10-year-old. And as I said, we'll hear more from them later, and we'll ask the same question of some of you parents. Describe from the parents' perspective the successful 10-year-old. That's coming up. But call in right now to fill in the blank. I'll know I've made it when 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Fill in the blank. I'll know I've made it when what? And if the 10-year-olds are very concrete, a little less so the successful 85-year-old, one Maya Angelou, talking last year to Oprah about making it as being wise.
I'm en route.
You're still
en route. I'm further along than I was. But I'm still en route.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when I know enough. I know a lot, and I'm grateful for that. I know enough to try to live what I know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a lot, but I still don't have it all.
Maya with Oprah. And what about for you? Is making it measured by the road to wisdom, by the number of dinners with your family, by how much you have helped others, by a certain amount of money? Come on, admit it. By your ability to enjoy the ride? Fill in the blank. I'll know I've made it when? 212-433-WNYC. Fill in the blank. I'll know I've made it when what? This is our overture to the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on making it. And by the way, if the 10-year-olds and Maya Angelou at 85 have ready answers to what is success and felt that they could get there or get close, not so Lena Dunham, who doing Girls for HBO has come to this conclusion about women, or girls as she calls you, in your 20s.
If you ask a girl in her 20s, are you a happy person? I think she can say, I have happy moments, but I don't think it's possible. Maybe people will radically disagree with me, but I don't really think it's possible to be sort of an at-peace human when you are between 22 and 30.
Really, Lena Dunham? Really? You can't be happy in your 20s of all decades? Women, if you're in the girls' demographic, call in and talk back to Lena Dunham or agree with her. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I'll know I've made it when. 212-433-9692. Fill in the blank. I'll know I've made it when what? Rob in Montclair. Hi, Rob.
And great show. I'm grateful for your program. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. How will you know you've made it?
I know that I've made it when I've given more than I've received. I try to practice the art of self-reflection, the Japanese style of Nikon, and ask three very simple questions. What have I received today? What have I today?
Rob, thank you very much. And I'll know I've made it when? Brian in Greenpoint?
Hey, I've lived in New York for a while now, and I've always thought to myself that I'll know I've made it when I have a parking spot that I can call my own, and I don't need to wait for alternative street parking anymore.
Making it in New York, your own parking spot. Jim in Hoboken, you'll know you've made it when?
Well, sort of a cautionary tale, more, Brian. You know you've made it when you've worked your entire life working at a craft such as mine, and you have a deadline, and you happen to miss your dad's 65th birthday.
Oh. So that's a conflict. Making it was what?
Choosing between losing something that your parents just said, go, 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 you can do it. Professors, teachers, do it, do it. And it's music for television, deadlines. It's due Monday, party Saturday. You got to get there. And if you don't do it, you're only as good as your last job, and you're fired, and you'll never be heard from again, and you're totally conflicted. At least I was. And I told my dad, I was like, what do I do? He said, well, we'll meet up during the week. But it still eats at me, and it'll always eat at me, because you only have one 65th birthday, and you only have one dad.
But no question about where your dad's definition of making it lies. He said, well, oh, we'll get together during the week.
He's so chill. Yeah, he really has a great perspective. I think it bothers me. I know it bothers me more than him.
Jim, thank you very much. TJ on Twitter tweeted us, I'll know I made it when my student loans are finally paid off. Sally Mae estimates about 20 years and 5 months. Daniela in Brooklyn, how will you know when you've made it?
Well, the world is different now, Brian, than ever before. I'm 73. I've published 16 books. I have an American Book Award. My family loves me. I care for them. But as an activist all my life in every kind of social activism, anti-war, feminism, all of it, right now I will know I have made it if I have been one of the people who have helped to halt global warming.
Ah.
Because nothing will matter if we go past the tipping point in 10 or 15 years. So I'll know I've made it if we've reduced carbon emissions below 350 parts per million and all of life on the planet, including my beloved grandchildren, can survive.
So you'll know you've made it not just when you've accomplished something, not just when you've given back, but when the world is a better place.
Well, when the world will survive, because we aren't facing the fact of how dire climate crisis is. I study the science, and we have only 10, maybe 15 years at most to save all life, all culture, all books, all children, all animals, and all life on Earth. Just 15 years before we will reach a tipping point beyond return.
Daniela, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. All right, Daniela on a mission, no doubt about what making it means to her. Josephine and Hastings on Hudson, you'll know you've made it when what?
Well, we go from the macro to the micro. I'll know that I have made it when all the people I'm related to can gather together at an event that's not a funeral and fully enjoy being together.
Thank you very much. Natalie in Montclair wants to talk back to Lena Dunham, I think. Hi, Natalie. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Yeah, I do. I am a 20-year-old woman, and I think it is absolutely possible to be happy, but I think that there's a difference between being at peace, which would be more content, and being happy. I just think they're two very different emotions that shouldn't get mixed up in one another, and I think that being at peace with yourself is something that is very attainable as a woman in your 20s, and being happy is something that is like always going to like go up and go down and back and forth and isn't as stable as content.
And accepting that arc, that series of curves, that's sort of the underpinning foundation of happiness?
Yeah. And being comfortable with yourself, which is part of being content and at peace.
Thank you very much. All right. Carolita on Twitter, I'll know I've made it when my day job and my real work are the same thing. Joe on Twitter, I'll know I've made it when the collection agency stops calling me up. Ivan on Twitter, I'll know I've made it when I no longer need to set my alarm clock. Ha. Dan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You'll know you've made it when what?
When when I have self-sufficient adult kids who have their own families and can contribute to society.
Because what? Because you will have raised successful children, or because you can stop being so involved and kick back on the weekends?
The former. Because, you know, being a parent is a 24-hour job, and now you finally see the fruits of your labor, and I think that's very, very rewarding as a parent.
Thank you very much. Christopher in Brooklyn, you'll know you've made it when...
When I can buy a scratch-off Win for Life ticket and throw it away without scratching it because I'm financially content.
Financially content, financially secure. You'll know you've made it. Jocelyn in Rockland County, you'll know you've made it when?
I can be on the Brian Lehrer Show.
You've made it.
I've made it.
Jocelyn.
That's when I've made it.
Thank you very much. Roshan on Twitter, I'll know I've made it when my mom says she's proud of me, which she does at least once a week, other directed toward your mother. Another from Twitter, I'll know I've made it. Well, this person writes, I don't feel pressure to make it. Ha, we'll bring that one up with one of our guests. Larry in East Orange, you'll know you've made it when?
When I can meet some members of my original family, my birth family, because I was adopted in New York State. And legally, I'm prevented from knowing my parents' identity.
Right. We just did this segment with respect to New Jersey, where they passed the open records law. Now this fight is beginning in New York.
Well, it's not beginning.
Well, it's going to another...
On for absolutely. Years and years and years.
Right. But it's going to another level right now, politically.
Yeah, but it's really... It's a story that you guys should cover.
We just did, and we will again. Larry in East Orange will know he's made it when he can meet his birth parents. Anna in Ridgewood, you'll know you've made it when?
Well, I also want to respond to Lena Dunham's quote that women in her 20s can't be at peace with themselves. I'm 22 turning 23 pretty soon. I'm pretty at peace with myself, but I think the hardest thing for me to overcome as just a woman in my 20s has been my body image and comparing myself to other women around me and in the media. And as someone who's overcome the eating disorder, I feel like I've made it. I feel like I'm at a point where I'm at peace with myself. And, I'm a happy person in my 20s.
Anna, thank you very much. And Yuli in Cold Spring, you'll know you've made it when?
when I stop asking myself if I am happy and I have made it. So that's when I will know that I'm happy.
Have you done that yet?
Well, you know, like when I was 20, I'm almost 40, someone asked me if I was happy, and that was the worst thing ever happened to me, because I said, well, I have never asked myself, and until then I think I was happy, and then all went down from there.
Too much awareness, too much self-consciousness.
There it is.
You need the innocence of a child back, and then you'll know you've made it. Yuli, thank you very much. And thanks to you all for kicking us off the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Making It Overture with all of you as the instrumentalists. Coming up, part two, Making It and Marriage. Stay with us. Up to the east side, finally getting a piece of the pie. It's our family meeting on Making It on the Brian Lehrer Show today. Let's talk about making it in the age of inequality. Here's a conundrum. If you reject money as the definition of making it, okay, fine, but it's becoming harder to make it as a family, that non-money thing, to even form a family than it once was without money. Call up and tell us, how much do you need your lover to make before you will marry him or her? 212-433-WNYC. Specific question, single people, do you ask yourself this? Do you struggle with it? Do you date on this basis? Call up and tell us, how much do you need your lover to make before you will marry him or her or consider it in anyone you're seeing? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Anyone willing to be honest and candid about this? And with us for this is Naomi Kahn. Also with us, June Carbone. Together, they are authors of a new book called Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. They are law professors at George Washington University and the University of Minnesota, respectively. Naomi, June, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thanks. Great to be here. Yes, happy to be here. And we definitely think making it means being on your show.
Ha. And I think making it means having you on my show. So part of your premise is that marriage markets are different today than they were in the time of, say, Pride and Prejudice, when the low-income Bennett parents were plotting for the success of their daughters. Listen.
It is taken by a young man of large fortune from the north of England. A single man of large fortune, my dear. What a fine thing for our girls.
How so? How can it affect them?
Oh, Mr. Bennett, how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I'm thinking of his marrying one of them.
For a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Indeed. That from the BBC adaptation in the 90s of Pride and Prejudice, which was set 200 years ago, almost exactly, in 1813. And I guess, June, that's kind of an extreme example from another time and place. You know, for the working class girl to marry a rich guy, and that was the archetypal definition of making it in Pride and Prejudice. But does that set up the premise of your book?
It does. You know, one of the things that I was just in the UK, and I mentioned that history. There's a period not long after the Industrial Revolution where something like 20% of women in England didn't marry at all. And the view was you couldn't get married, the women couldn't get married until they found a guy who had the right amount of income to support them in the manner that befit their status. And there are a lot of jokes, if you look at the historians, about second sons who in an age of primogeniture didn't inherit the family estate, going off to seek their fortunes, and perhaps that really explains the empire. You couldn't get married until you had the right amount of money, the man, and the woman couldn't get married until she had a man with enough money to support her. And that pushed marriage in that era well into the 20s, an extraordinary thing.
Indeed. So flash forward 150 years to the Mad Men era, when we might have thought that professional men were happy to marry their secretaries if they saw them as cute and maybe deferential. That's how we look back on that era. But even then, Joan and Peggy from Mad Men wondered about the optics of one such impending union.
I'll probably make her a copywriter. He's not going to want to be married to his secretary.
Really?
That's the way it works for some.
You know, I just saved this company. I signed the first new business since Lucky Strike left. But it's not as important as getting married. Again.
Well, I was just made director of agency operations. A title, no money, of course. And if they poured champagne, it must have been while I was pushing the mail cart.
A pretty face comes along, and everything goes out the window.
Well, I learned a long time ago to not get all my satisfaction from this job.
That's
All right. That from Mad Men. And my guests, June Carbone and Naomi Kahn, authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. And which one of you was laughing there at that fiction and thinking, yeah, that's worth placing as a moment of, you know, fiction in its real life time and context of Marriage Markets? Naomi?
I suspect we were both chuckling about that, just as we think about what's happened to women's status in the United States, what's happened to women's status in the workforce. Today, the women who are most likely to get married and to stay married are women who have a bachelor's degree. So it's the most highly educated women who are most likely to be the ones who are married. And so it doesn't take a promotion, but what it takes is a college degree to be in that group of women who are most likely to be married.
Oh, can I add?
Uh-huh.
What we found that stunned us is it's not just the college degree. The only group in society whose marriage rates have increased are the top 5% of women by income.
So maybe once upon a time, a manager would marry his secretary and call her a copywriter. Today, managers marry other managers, contributing to the age of inequality.
Yes,
exactly. That's precisely what's happening. Managers do marry other managers, and yeah, it's women at the top who have not seen their marriage rates go down over the past 40 years since just after the Mad Men era. And
is it too broad a question to ask why?
Well, that's of course, we spent an entire book answering that question. But a big part of our answer is that when you look at what both men and women want, they want a partner. They want a partner who complements their sense of themselves, where they're going, who's going to help them to get there, with whom they can juggle, you know, trading off, picking up the kids after work, paying the bills. The men do not want to support families. They want somebody who's going to help them support their families. The women want somebody who they can trust, they can rely on, but they see themselves as in it together. Now, if you're going to be in it together, you need to have some idea where you're going to land before you can figure out the right partner. I had two children living in Washington, D.C. right after college, and my sense is everybody was looking around their shoulder at everybody else. Should I be going to graduate school? Do I need to leave this job and move to another city to advance my career? Is the person I'm with somebody who is speeding me along or holding me back? And it's not Pride and Prejudice. It's not cold-blooded calculation. It's, does the person I'm with make me feel good about myself? Do I feel we're getting there together, or are we moving in opposite directions? If you don't know where you're going to land or where the next job is coming from, that's hard to figure out.
So, listeners, how much do you need your lover to know that or to make, just financially, before you'll marry him or her? 212-433-WNYC, or tell us a story along these lines. from your life. 212-433-9692. And Robert in Boreham Hill, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking the call. It's a great topic, actually.
Glad you're here.
About three years ago, I asked my girlfriend to move in with me, my wife. And I was, I had saved money from being a writer and things I had done, but I was sort of in between. I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I asked her to move in, and she said no. She said, start a business, get a job, do something, because I don't think it's right that I move in with you just to make things easier. And that wasn't really why I asked her. And I was truly insulted and truly hurt by this. And I called all of my friends. I called my family. I called my dad and told them I'd asked her to move in and what she had said. And every single one of them said, good for her.
Wow.
Good for her for not just moving in with you just to make it easier or just because it's time or because you love each other. She wanted to kick you in the butt a little bit. And it worked. I started a business. It took off. We moved in and we got married. But we talk about those days, about how she was working still in film and television and doing very well and in a union and picked up a lot of the slack of the relationship. I mean, it's not like I was living hand to mouth, but if we wanted to go to a great restaurant or we wanted to go away, it was on her.
Do you still write?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. It seems, you know, once you... you're in a relationship and a lot of the pressure goes away of dating. I found that I was, things went very well for me, but she said no. And it was a good 6 or 8 months before I said, gee, I better do something. Cause I shouldn't just not do anything. It's just stupid.
What do you think about the gender roles there? Like if it was the opposite, if you were the one in her career position and you had a girlfriend who was in your position and you loved her, do you think you would have asked her to move in? It's a hypothetical,
no,
I realize.
No. I wouldn't have. It took me 3 years and a kind of a successful business and us being married for me to look back and go, she was right. And if I was in her position, I would have said the exact same thing.
Robert,
and if I was dating a girl who was sort of lost professionally, I would probably have to insist that she sort of get it together before we figure yourself out, and then we'll figure us out.
Robert, thank you very much. And there, Naomi and June, is your book in a nutshell.
That's precisely it. And it helps also explain why the age of marriage is moving up. People want financial stability and emotional maturity from their partners before they get married. And so the age of marriage has increased over the past 50 years for both men and women.
By the way, the tweets on I'll Know I've Made It When are still streaming in, and they're amazing, so keep them coming. We'll read a whole bunch of them on the air as we go through our family meeting on making it here on The Brian Lehrer Show for the next couple of hours. Check out our Twitter feed, see where people are posting at Brian Lehrer, to see the way other listeners are filling in the blank. Benjamin on Twitter just wrote, I'll know I've made it when the parole board decides I've paid my debt to society. How about for you? You'll know you've made it when. You can tweet that in 140 characters at Brian Lehrer. Mary in Manhattan, what do you need in a partner before you would consider marrying him or her? Mary, you there?
Yes. Sorry. Hi, Brian.
Hi. So, yeah, you called to talk about money and dating?
Yeah. So I'm 34 years old. I'm a dentist. I make very good money. And when I'm dating, I am very conscious of how much he makes. And I think it's very important that he makes as much as I do, if not more. I bring a lot to the table. And honestly, I want somebody who brings as much. And maybe that's why it's been such a struggle. Maybe that's why I'm 34 and still looking. And as you were saying earlier, that the age of marriage has gone up. I have a lot of friends who are in the same situation and same age, same level of education, if not higher.
And do you find difficulty in finding guys who are making as much as you are as a dentist?
Yeah, I do. It hasn't been easy.
Why do you need that?
I think as I've gotten older, I feel that financial security is very important, and I
when I think about having kids and having and giving them all the opportunities that I've had and that I can give, I want somebody to be able to be on the same page as that, I guess.
Can you fill in the blank? I'll know I've made it when?
When I've found the right partner to have a family with. That's the state I'm in right now in my life.
Mary, good luck out there. Thank you very much. Back to Twitter. DJ, I'll know I've made it when I'm working hard because I want to, not because I have to. Joey, I'll know I've made it when I have a washer and dryer in my apartment in New York City. Gina, I'll know I've made it when I can go grocery shopping without checking my bank balance. So, Naomi and June, authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. You write that the American reality that inspired your book is that divorce and out-of-wedlock births have become markers of class. What are some of the stats that show us that divide?
Well, let's start with divorce.
Go ahead, Jane.
Okay, and you can talk about non-marital births. When you look at divorce, there was a chart we saw from Sarah McClanahan's work that stunned us, and it showed the divorce rate.
And she's a sociologist at Princeton.
And what she showed is, in the 90s, we started hearing divorce rates are leveling off. And then we saw these numbers. They weren't leveling off. They were moving in two opposite directions. So if you look at college graduates as a group, the divorce rates by 2004 were back to what they had been in the mid-60s, before the sex revolution, before no-fault divorce. And if you ask why, it is this later age of marriage and like marrying like, people finding somebody they think are real partners. For everyone else, divorce rates were continuing to go up. So you had the family moving in two diametrically opposed directions at the same time by class.
And what's the relationship between money or class and the divorce rates? Poorer people can't be happy together?
No, you know, this is one of the things we've spent a lot of time on, and it's hard to separate, but Paul Amato, another sociologist, has a great book that kind of captures this. And what he describes is, let's take two career couples. If you look at college graduates and you look at people who really have careers, well, they're not spending any time together, but conflict is way down, and the relationships are pretty stable. If you look at the working class and you look at women who are working full-time and don't want to be, they are very divorce-prone. They want to be spending more time at home with the kids. They feel their husbands are not successful in bringing home enough money to allow them to take care of the family. And at the same time, we find that men who are unemployed or underemployed help out less at home than men who are fully employed. If the men feel good about themselves, they help out. If they feel they are unsuccessful, then the women are pestering them, and the men help out less. And this triggers something that really undermines relationships. So you've got this pressure to perform. And again, it's tougher in many ways for the working class. People who are doing reasonably well trade off. There are a number of arrangements, but they feel good about themselves. If they don't feel good about themselves, or if work has become much more unstable, men are much more likely, especially working class men with high school degrees, to be cycling in and out of the labor market. That's destructive.
And Naomi, you want to pick that up?
I want to add that we're talking generally about statistics. We're not talking about any individual people, which is why the people who are calling in, the people who are responding on Twitter, their experiences won't necessarily always match what the statistics show. So, of course, you don't need money or you don't need a college degree to be happy in your marriage. But statistically, you're more likely to remain in your marriage for a longer period of time if you have an annual income, say, over $50,000, and if you have a college degree. So we're talking quite generally as opposed to about any specific relationship.
But wasn't it the opposite in the past? Or is that a myth, that the more working class Americans would stay together, and the wealthier Americans, especially, let's say, in the 1970s, when a lot of, I think, middle and upper middle class divorces started to happen as, you know, women started to feel their oats of independence and want to get out of these feminine mystique marriages, Mad Men era marriages that were holding them back. And people in the working class would look down their noses at the wealthier people who are looking for some, you know, highfalutin notion of satisfaction.
Actually, we present that a little differently. What you see is that the divorce rates go up for everybody in the 70s. But they do so in pretty parallel fashions. College graduates are still less likely to divorce, but the divorce rates are going up for both groups. What's different about the working class? The working class used to be more likely to marry. The top women, especially by income, were less likely to marry. They're more likely to marry now. So that's changed. But the big thing that's changed is what working class marriages are about. So in the old days, what happened is, you know, the marriage occurred because typically the woman got pregnant, reached in 1960s, close to a third of brides gave birth within 8.5 months of the nuptials, a figure last seen in 1800. But after they got married, what happened is the men could get jobs. They went off to work. They hung out with the guys. The women were in bed, you know, the women hung out with their families, their sisters, their mothers, and they raised the kids. And they had roles that didn't require they spend a lot of time with each other. Right now, that's a lot more complicated. Woman is more likely to be working and to feel she has to work. She needs the man to help out. The working class model, which is you get married after she gets pregnant, involved two people who don't know each other very well at the time the pregnancy occurs, which is different from the college graduate model.
Mm-hmm.
That still happens. The difference is today that group doesn't marry and doesn't necessarily have very much in common at the time the baby is born. And so the systems that took a man with no skills, high school degree, put him in a job and kept him there with promotions and benefits and status, and a system that said to the woman, okay, you're going to take care of the kids, that's a meaningful role, and you have this help from your family in doing it, that system's gone.
It's our family meeting on Making It on The Brian Lehrer Show today. We're asking on Twitter, you'll know you've made it when, fill in the blank, and Mercy tweets us, I'll know I've made it when I don't have to have a roommate anymore. And then she adds in another tweet, and I have an air conditioner. God bless summer in New York. And Tessa tweets, I'll know I've made it when my child no longer asks for money. And in this segment, we're asking you on the phones, how much do you need your lover to make before you'll marry him or her, as we talk about making it and marriage. And Richard in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how you doing, Brian?
Good.
I'm gay, and what I'm finding now is that to bring this up to the 21st century, on some of the gay social apps and networking apps like Grindr, you'll find guys who say, if you want to meet for one night, that's fine, but relationships require a credit score of 700 or above.
Ooh,
now, I don't even know my credit score.
That's direct.
I should, but what the hell? I mean, I can't believe that. And I'm actually underemployed right now. I'm one of those guys with a lot of education who are underemployed. And I'm finding I go on, I see what I'm doing because I have a part-time job with the government. And then, boom, period. It's vacant. Nothing happens. So, I mean, it's still going on. And people, I mean, there are guys who I still can't get over. There's guys who require credit scores. I'm sorry, that's my rant.
Could it be that credit scores reflect something that's not just income, but like responsibility, dependability, paying your bills? I'm guessing you can have a relatively low income but a relatively high credit score if you've always paid your bills.
I guess. I don't even know my credit score, so
yeah.
I don't know.
Right. So that's your rant. Richard, thank you very much. And I may be wrong about that. Maybe you need a high income to have a credit score of 750. Just speculating there.
Can I add something about marriage as a market?
Yeah.
I mean, it's when we titled the book Marriage Market, people keep saying, well, marriage isn't a market. Marriage is always based on love. It's based on romance. It's based on soulmates. And yet, I mean, your question, how much does your lover need to make before you get married, this last person's response shows that some people really do think of marriage as a market. And even if you don't think of marriage as a market, there are still all kinds of supply and demand parts of getting married and of who you'll choose to get married.
So how fundamentally do you think this means that the meaning of marriage has changed in the last 50 years? Because Richard identifies himself as gay. As more gays and lesbians crave marriage, it seems more straight people are becoming wary of it. And the idea of making it as a married household is shifting under our feet, maybe in several directions at the same time.
Absolutely. No, you know, some of what we were describing and some of the conversations we have with more conservative scholars is about this idea of gender. So if you take the old model, it's the man in the Mad Men era was expected to take care of his wife. And but he could get a job if he wanted one. Now, no guarantee you can get a job. And if the man was expected to take care of her, she was expected to defer to him. He was the boss. He's the head of the family. Now you ask the question, what is marriage about? It's not about that. It's not about somebody taking care of someone else who is completely dependent. And one of the things we wrote about in our last book that we're excited about is we see same-sex relationships as really part of a move away from these rigidly defined gender roles to redefine the meaning of partnership. In Minnesota, which is a very marriage-oriented place, and we have same-sex marriage as a result of a ballot initiative, and then the legislature adopted it right after that, you can see that there is a shift toward greater emphasis on marriage as the sign of commitment, but not gender as the defining element.
Right.
That's complicated.
But conservatives, I think, would flip the script in another way, many of them, that rather than the age of inequality causing single parenthood, they would say rampant single parenthood is causing the age of inequality, that if a child is in a home with two adults, they could be gay or they could be straight, no matter what roles they take on in the relationship. But at least one works full-time at any job. I saw a stat the other day. 95% of those kids are not living in poverty. So how do you address the chicken and the egg question there between single parenthood and inequality?
Well, on that we say that if you have two people with marginal employment who are each below the poverty line and you put them together, you're still going to have a poor household. And so the real answer, what we argue is that if you want to do anything, if we as a society want to do anything about single parenthood, then the real answer is creating more economic security for both men and women.
And we say something a little more complicated. I would say on the point Naomi just made, we're having a dialogue with some conservative writers who say they agree that you're not going to see the family strengthened without jobs, especially for blue-collar men. But we make a more complex argument in the book, and it goes like this. What greater inequality has done is to change the way men and women match up. So at the top, take all college graduates, take median as opposed to mean figures, and that is, take the numbers, don't take averages, and you find men have been the big winners. There are a lot more high-income men seeking to pair with a smaller number of successful women. When that happens, marriage rates tend to increase. Now take what's happening to the rest of society. Men have been the big losers. They are not as economically secure as they were 40 years ago. But women are better off. So what's happening is you're writing off an extraordinary percentage of men at the bottom due to mass incarceration, chronic unemployment, substance abuse, men who don't hold full-time jobs. don't feel good about themselves and aren't good partners. They're effectively unmarriageable. And what that means is you have a larger number of women and a smaller number of men. In every society where that happens, divorce goes up, marriage declines, non-marital births increase. It's true in France after World War II. It's true in lots of societies.
Marie in Cliffside Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your story?
Good. So I'm 26 years old, and I've always considered myself very idealistic. Just like a lot of young people my age, I thought marriage was about love and not so much about income. But I actually surprised myself last year when I had to make a really tough decision. I had been going out with this guy for about 3 years. We were pretty serious, and I was starting to think about the next step. And I am a college graduate, and I have a pretty secure job. I make more than $75,000 a year. And although he had a full-time job, he was not a college graduate. And I saw that my goals or the stability and security that I was looking for wasn't going to be available with him in the long run. And as much in love as I was with him, I didn't see him being that dependable or that secure. And it's funny, I was listening to you talk about credit score and what that really means, not necessarily income-wise, but as far as it relates to behaviors and paying your bills on time. And I think that you're very right. I think you hit it right on the money where, you know, you want to believe that you can marry an artist and live this very romantic life. But when it comes to having a stable relationship and being married in the long run and not thinking about divorce, you do need that level of stability. And I ended up breaking up with him. I lost interest in him because I didn't see him as my partner. I didn't see him challenging me and being my real equal. So
did anybody you know call you cold and calculating and too unromantic?
No. I mean, because I think I have both polar opposites. I am very romantic, and but I do feel that I need someone who's going to share the same views in life and the long-term views. I don't know if it affects any because I'm a female, and I do come from a very traditional household where my mom was a housewife, but I can tell you that, like, I was looking for someone who was as stable as I was or even more stable in the sense of security and financial security. And
Did you find someone?
No, but, I mean, at this point in my life, I'm just trying to focus on my career and my education. I didn't go to graduate school, and I'm thinking about going to graduate school. So if he happens to come along, then great, but I'm not necessarily looking to get married right away.
Marie, thank you very much. You contributed to the conversation a lot. I can see a lot of heads nodding out there and maybe a few people tisking and saying, she'll never get married, but probably not true. Nicola in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicola.
Hi, Brian. So I wanted to basically address this to your authors. They were saying about higher income women being more likely nowadays to get married. And I think it may be different in the black community where I have a kid sister who's in her middle 30s. And she's finding it very difficult to meet a guy who's on her level. She's got a PhD in psychology. She's gone into private practice on the side while holding a full-time job at a university, and she's finding it really difficult to meet men.
June, Naomi, want to talk to Nicola?
Again, statistically, that's absolutely right. When we talk about marriage markets, there are different marriage markets, and race is certainly one of those factors in a marriage market. And if you look at the number of kind of men with comparable education to your friend, then that's absolutely right. There are fewer men in that market. So yeah, there are all kinds of different kinds of marriage markets that play out based on not just education but also based on race. And the black marital rate at all incomes and for all educations is lower than the white marital rate.
June Carbone and Naomi Kahn, yes, as we are out of time for this segment, are the authors of Marriage Markets, How Inequality is Remaking the American Family. Thanks for contributing so much to our family meeting on Making It today.
And thanks for helping us make it on your show.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And it's our family meeting on Making It today. Now we're going to ask, what makes a successful 10-year-old? 212-433-WNYC. Parents, grandparents, listeners, when you think about the success of your children, and I'd love to hear from people who have roughly a 10-year-old in the house right now or a grandchild of that age. Do you usually take the long view, looking at what they'll eventually become, or do you also think about what makes your child successful in the moment? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's listen to some 9- and 10-year-olds who came into our studio recently for a school trip. We played a short excerpt of this earlier. We'll play a longer clip now. It's about 2 minutes. 10-year-olds, 9- and 10-year-olds who came into our studios recently for a school trip from the Little Red Schoolhouse in Lower Manhattan, tell us what being a successful 10-year-old means to them.
What makes a successful 10-year-old?
I think that a successful 10-year-old is being able to take a risk and also commitment. So if you start something, it's best to finish it.
Some kids, like, even if they're not the best at sports, they really commit to it and they go to every game and they try their best.
Or I could just feel successful that my handwriting got better or something. Like, it's not one thing that makes you successful. It's like anything that makes you feel proud.
I think what makes a successful 10-year-old is confidence.
I think that it matters to you, because other people might be like, oh yeah, if I go to the moon, that means that I am successful. But other people might just think, oh yeah, if I read this giant book, I'm successful.
What I think makes a successful 10-year-old is someone who's willing to start something and then finish it. Also helping out the community and doing stuff that will be kind to others, even if it puts them at sort of a risk or something.
Let's say you're 93 and you're about to die and you've done all these things. You can feel like, oh yeah, I'm really successful. But if you're like 2 years old and you're thinking, oh, I'm so successful, I just learned how to walk, then it really matters who you're talking to.
Things that you do that you feel proud of, they all make one big thing that can make you a successful 10-year-old. So, like, if you're, like, really proud of yourself for making, like, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or something, that, if you only do it once, then it's not that big of a deal. But if you do more things that you're really proud of, then it all kind of comes together to make one big thing, and one big thing that will make you successful.
I think a successful 10-year-old is someone who accomplished all of their goals when they were 9.
The successful 10-year-old being someone who accomplished all their goals when they were 9. The previous kid making the perfect peanut butter and jelly sandwich, as long as you do it more than once. Kids from the Little Red Schoolhouse, fourth graders who visited our studio, and then one of our producers visited them at school with a microphone during this week. And for those kids, at least, their success seems really tied to effort. Can you believe how many 10-year-olds were talking about commitment in that clip and being able to take a risk? So that's what they say. But listeners, for you, is a 10-year-old success tied to academics, parents, or to sports? Is it more values-driven or philosophical? Pretty high-level thinking group of 10-year-olds there, many talking about charity and making the world a better place for others. Or is it just kid, you know, just, I mean, as the one said, well, maybe you don't have to go to the moon. Maybe you just have to read a book. And maybe you're saying, gosh, my kid ate a few servings of vegetables this week. That's success. Or finished reading a book. Or spent a few hours doing something other than on their screens. So give us a call. Parents, grandparents of 10-year-olds or kids thereabouts, what makes a successful 10-year-old in the moment? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. 833-9692. Are your notions of success about your 10-year-old really about them, or are they somewhat about you? Or maybe you can't really separate those two. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Are you a little like, come on, admit it, who out there is a little like Stan's dad in South Park at the Little League game, which results in a fist fight?
Strike.
That was no strike. What the hell is wrong with you, ump?
Good call, ump. Good call.
Come on, Alan. This pitcher throws like a girl.
What'd you say?
You heard me. You want me to kick your ass right here?
Randy, sit down.
You want a piece of me? Because I'm pretty sick of your goddamn mouth.
What do you want to do, huh? What do you want to do?
Randy, don't.
You better shut up, asshole.
Standing right here, how do you want to handle it?
I told you to shut up.
Ah, Jesus, not again.
So if you aren't that dad, we all know that dad, or somebody who maybe doesn't quite go that far on the youth sports field, but you wonder if they're going to go off and get all the way there one day, right? We know that guy. So listeners, what makes a successful 10-year-old, and what makes you okay with that? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, let's welcome KJ Dell'Antonia, lead writer and editor at the New York Times Motherlode blog, which is about just that. She is here with me now to contribute to our conversation about what makes a successful 10-year-old. Hi, KJ. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And 10 is an interesting age. I mean, it's, you know, not little, but it's before the teenage stuff.
Yeah, it's a really fun age. I think my daughter will turn 10 on, my older daughter, on Tuesday.
And you have four kids. We'll lay that down there. You for people who don't know your column, you write about them all. Are they different? Would you define success differently for your four different kids?
Absolutely. I think every parent should define success differently depending on, you know, who their child is and what they're capable of and just, you know, what they themselves might see as success. Now, when I think some things are general. For me, success at age 10 maybe involves being able to go into new situations comfortably and confidently, being polite and courteous with adults, you know, sort of being able to interact with both your peers and adults in a positive way, whether that's, you know, with great enthusiasm or maybe shyly, but still not, you know, not being anxious about the experience. I think that's a big part of success at 10.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. It's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on making it today. And Sima in Rockville Center, you're on WNYC. Hello, Sima.
Hi, good morning, Brian. I love listening to your show. It's the best part of my drive to work.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being there. This is a great conversation, and what I really liked was hearing that even 10-year-olds think there's a big wide range of what makes them successful, because that's what it is to be human. I have a 9-year-old. He'll be 10 in March, and in many ways he's emotionally much younger than 9, and yet intellectually he's well beyond 10. And what I say to him all the time is, my job in making you a successful person as somebody who's going to love you all the time, no matter what you do, is to make you okay with all those people who are not going to love you all the time, no matter what you do.
Uh-huh.
You know, making you polite, making you responsive when adults speak to you, just what your speaker was talking about, and also making you just okay, knowing yourself, knowing that something makes you feel comfortable or uncomfortable is a big part of being 10, because it's a big part of becoming a preteen. And feeling, knowing that you can bring your own brain to the conversation and your own opinion, and you don't have to follow the crowd, is a big thing that we're talking about now. And being successful for me would be, he knows who he is, as well as anybody does at 10, so that when he becomes a preteen, he can hold his own and not succumb to the pressure to be or do or not do certain things.
Do you have that conversation at that level? Like, knowing who you are, do you know who you are, my little 9-year-old?
I him all the time. You know, does that feel comfortable for you? When somebody says that to you, how does that feel to you? Does it feel okay to you if somebody leaves you out? Well, if it doesn't feel okay to you, then first, learn from it and don't leave anybody else out. But second, find the people that make you feel comfortable. This is about not seeking out relationships just to have relationships, but to have quality friends. And quality over quantity is a big conversation for us, too, because he's an only child, and I want him to have really good quality friends rather than I think that there's a sort of a falsehood to popularity that we, you know, oh, well, if you have 30 kids at your birthday party, you're the most popular kid. It's like, no, I'd rather that you know the names of your friends. I'd rather know their parents. I'd rather not have the maintenance of those relationships. I'd rather that you know who makes you feel good and who makes you feel like yourself, who makes you feel most comfortable.
Right. My three really close friends who I can have intimate conversations with, even at 10.
Hang out and build Legos with, or just saying, you know what, I don't want to do that today, and that'll be okay, and it doesn't end the friendship.
Sima, thank you very much. Great start. And we do have a 10-year-old calling in. I thought we wouldn't have any at this time on a school day. But Hugo in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hi, Hugo.
Hi. I think responsibility is one of the most important factors in a 10-year-old because it really reflects on who they are, and that matters in the long term.
So that's a very responsible thing to say, that success for a 10-year-old is responsibility. What about things that make you happy? In addition to your responsibility to others, how would you define success in terms of just what makes you feel happy?
Well, if you know you're responsible and then you become proud of yourself, then you can, like, be happy with yourself. And I think that's important, too.
Nice,
Hugo. Being proud of yourself.
Really, 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 really great. Is your school over for the year already? Is that why you're off today?
School's over.
Well, whatever school you're going to, it sounds like they're doing a good job, and your parents, too. So thanks for calling in.
Okay, thank you.
And KJ Della Antonia, lead writer and editor at the New York Times Motherlode blog. That was a wonderful, earnest kid. And
wasn't that great?
Yes. And, you know, and when I try to separate those two, responsibility to others and what just makes you feel like a success for yourself, he wouldn't do it. The responsibility was what made him feel good inside himself.
Yeah, I thought that was really super mature. I mean, wouldn't you like to hear that from any 10-year-old that they feel good when they feel good about how others, you know, how they're doing and what they're doing for the people around them. I thought that was fantastic. And I was also thinking about what Sima said, and that I think 10 is a great time to talk to your kid while they're sort of still talking about, you know, letting other people be other people. And when they get upset with you or maybe exclude you or do something that bothers you, recognizing that that's them doing that and you can still be who you are and make your choices. I think 10's a great time to be thinking about those things and talking about them.
Pam in Verona, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pam.
Hi, I love your show, and I happen to be home today from school
because
I teach. But my sons were in middle school, on the young end of middle school, probably fifth grade or maybe sixth. They were on the young end of their age group. And they were with a friend their age and his younger brother. And they were outside the school about an hour after school waiting for me to come and get them. And they got targeted by some older kids, a couple of older kids, one in particular, pushing them down, slurring their identities. There were some anti-Semitic remarks and name-calling. And also my sons are redheaded, so they were called gingers. And they were being pushed and shoved, and they tried to sort of, you know, defend themselves as best they could. But when the older kid who was doing this primarily left, they, all four of them, marched back into the school, even though school was over, and reported, said they wanted to file a complaint that they had just been bullied. And we were very impressed, and the assistant principal spoke with them, was very impressed that they had internalized what they had been taught,
What did they have been? What
was going to work for them?
So is that what it is that you're saying they were taught? They were taught that the system could work for them, and that after they were bullied, the act of filing the complaint represented success in a way?
Oh, definitely. They did not want revenge, and they were kind of a bit casual. I mean, they were shaken up, but they were a bit casual about, well, of course, this is what we would do.
What's the difference between seeking revenge and reporting the bullies to the system?
Well, the assistant principal is a marvelous fellow who was sat the kids down, who knew the kids who had been involved. One was sort of a bystander, sort of letting it happen, and one was actually doing the active bullying, and knew them and knew they were, at, you know, in the deepest part of themselves, good kids, and, you know, tried to make it a teachable moment for everybody. So I think that was really a positive. You know, it wasn't vengeful. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. They weren't intimidated. They weren't cowering. I felt that they stood up for themselves in a rational way.
Thank you. That's a great story, Pam. Thank you very much. Shakir in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shakir.
Yes, I was just going to say that many people covered many of the things that I was going to say, so I just wanted to be brief, except for the academics, like that goes without saying. Watching, you know, their adaptations to different things, new situations, because you kind of teach them a base. You can't teach them and prepare them for every situation, so you kind of watch them to see if a lot of the things that you've been teaching have been sinking in, just to see at home common sense things. See what they're willing to do on their own, coming from the base that you've taught them, how they interact with siblings, knowing their address and, you know, contact information if you ask them on the spot, or just their emotional state. Like somebody said, happiness, I believe the 10-year-old said, knowing that he's happy, seeing them and how they are emotionally and socially, there's a lot more other than academics, but yeah, responsible. Their how they deal, their manners. You know, if they're polite, without you having to say anything, just watching them in different situations and seeing how they respond to them is kind of how you can tell or measure the success of a 10-year-old, and kind of knowing maybe even from your own experience what they should be able to handle and what they're ready for. And then you can kind of measure their success and, you know, what's going to come down the line based on that.
Great stuff. Shakir, thank you very much. So KJ Dell'Antonio from the New York Times Motherlode blog, all these great markers of success for a 10-year-old. somebody pushing back on Twitter writes, the concept of labeling a 10-year-old unsuccessful is sick. Not that we've done that. But all these people have all these markers for successful 10-year-olds. Do you get letters at Motherlode from people who may be thinking about all these criteria? And, you know, I think the usefulness of this conversation, hopefully, is mostly to broaden people's notion of what makes a successful 10-year-old. But do you get letters from people who are worried that their 10-year-olds or so are not meeting their criteria of success? And do you write about that?
Well, I think, you know, once in a while you get, I think every parent at 10 is maybe the start of the moment when you're stepping back and your child is, you know, you shouldn't be nudging them and saying, say thank you to everything. They're starting to show those last 10 years, right? And we are parents and we are investing in our kids and we are feeling like, now this is my son or my daughter, they're in school, they're out in the world without me, and the things that they do might surprise me, or I don't have a whole lot of control over them. So I do think, you know, it's the beginning of their independence, this double digits. So I think it's a natural worry. I don't think it's a question of my 10-year-old is unsuccessful. I think it's more about, are they ready? You know, are they engaging the way that they ought to be? Are they able to handle the things that you'd like them to be able to handle on their own? Or are they still needing more help? In which case, maybe, you know, there's things you want to do, things you want to talk about, things you want to think about with them.
You know, I'm still thinking about Pam and Verona and her story of how her bullied 10-year-olds mm-hmm. reacted. Makes me think of the famous Lao Tzu aphorism, who said, treat those who are good with goodness, and also treat those who are not good with goodness. Thus, goodness is attained. And it's a pretty high-minded thing to get out of a 10 or 11-year-old who's just been bullied.
And I also was impressed. I think people underestimate how hard it is to admit that you've been bullied. It's not just a question of revenge or reporting or anything like that. There's also that, oh, my gosh, I have to go to an adult or go to other kids and sort of reveal myself to be a target, reveal, you know, whatever weakness in me that this person saw. I have to know that that is not a weakness, that I can say it. And I think that's one of the difficult things about being bullied, that people don't think very hard about it, that it actually takes courage to speak up, not because you're afraid of the bully, but because it takes a real acceptance of who you are, I think, which is, you know, sort of coming back to that funny phrase for a 10-year-old, who you are. But but they are their own people. They're getting separate from us.
You know, there's a funny scene in the show Modern Family where Jay, the older dad, is crowing that his stepson is really great at fencing. And it causes Claire and Phil, who have 3 school-age kids, to think about their kids' accomplishments like this.
I know you're not supposed to care, but it's kind of cool to have a kid in your house who's the best at something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, our kids are great.
They're the greatest.
Gosh, we're blessed.
We are. But are they the best at something? I'd have to think about that.
Well, Alex is great at every single thing she tries, so, you know, mm-hmm. she'll find her specialty.
She will, and Haley is...
Haley is so pretty.
Gorgeous.
Oh, gosh.
Gorgeous girl.
I mean, so she can meet someone who's the best at something.
That's right.
And then I guess that leaves Luke. We dropped the ball a little bit on that one.
Yeah, a little bit.
How many of the people in that scene did you want to punch? And how many times?
No kidding.
So
can be hard to be at it this time of year at school assemblies. It's graduation, you know, and kids they're saying, all right, would all the kids who won the award for the math club please stand up? And all the other kids are standing. You know, I think a parent, we probably don't want to be that way, but, you know, you probably think, oh, well, my kid's really good at drawing. You know, we all have that in us a little tiny bit.
So we leave this portion of our family meeting on Making It here. We thank all of the 10-year-olds from the Little Red Schoolhouse. What an amazing group they were. We thank the 10-year-old who called up and all the grown-ups who called up. And we thank KJ Dell'Antonia, the lead writer and editor from the New York Times Motherlode blog, for contributing to our conversation about what makes a successful 10-year-old. KJ, thanks.
Thank you. Super fun.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It is our family meeting on Making It. And we will go from the successful 10-year-old to those of you who are 50-plus, and maybe the dreams you had earlier in your life didn't all come true. How do you redefine making it then? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and yes, it's our family meeting on Making It today. So far, we've heard the 10-year-olds and their parents defining a successful 10-year-old. We've heard some 20 and 30-somethings saying what markers of success they need in a lover to consider marrying that person. So let's move on to midlife and beyond. You might be the CEO or a vice president or the department chairman at the top of your career. Or maybe it didn't quite work out that way, like in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I had it all planned out. First, he'd take over the history department. Then when Daddy retired, he'd take over the whole college, you know? That was the way it was supposed to be. Getting angry, baby, huh? That was the way it was supposed to be. All very simple. And Daddy thought it was a good idea, too, for a while. Until he started watching for a couple of years. Getting angrier? Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. That maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff. That maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great big fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
Oh, it's exhausting just hearing 45 seconds of that. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That'll get you depressed at any age. But if you're 50 plus and the dreams didn't quite come true and you realize some things are no longer possible, how do you adjust to the limits of your professional life? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If you're 50 plus, how do you accept or not the limits on your professional life? 212-433-9692. Whether you are the CEO but wanted to be President of the United States, hello, Mitt, how's life these days? Or whether you're the long-timer in a stable job but with not much upward mobility, or whether you're the frustrated, unemployed dad in glory days. My man worked 20 years on the line, and they let him go. Now he works, goes out looking for work. They just tell him that he's too old. I was 9 years old when he was working in the Metro for a grand assembly line. Now he just sits on a stool. Bruce Springsteen from Glory Days, the last line there, the glory days he ain't never had, as the lyric goes. So if you're 50 plus and the dreams didn't quite come true, or some of them did, but some of them never will, and you realize some things are no longer possible, or you believe they're not, how do you adjust to the limits in your life? 212-433-WNYC. And with us now, as your calls are coming in, is Janet Taylor, a life coach and a psychiatrist practicing community mental health here in New York City, and a contributor to the AARP's Life Reimagined project. Dr. Taylor, thanks for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian.
You get depressed when you hear that Springsteen song?
I don't get depressed when I hear the Springsteen song, but I think the point is your professional life is not the only place that you can have success, and sometimes there are other avenues where if your job's not working out well, you can still find purpose and find potential, and that's the point.
Sure. But you have a Michael Jordan quote on your site: I can accept failure, I can't accept not trying. And I assume you have that as a motivational tool to get people to try more. But I think the first part of that is at least as difficult. I can accept failure. Well, I don't know if Michael Jordan can accept failure so much, but why did you feature that quote? And do you think about the first half?
Of course I think about the first half. And in reality, if you are extending yourself, if you're giving, you're not going to make it all the time. And I think that what Michael Jordan, I mean, even he, you know, didn't win every championship every year for his life. But the fact is, sometimes when you are working hard, you might hit a closed door, but you still have to get up and practice and work harder. And I think that certainly exemplified his work ethic. And I think it exemplifies the work ethic of a lot of other people, because if we all succumb to when we didn't make it, then why try at all? And that's not our spirit. That's not the American spirit. And sometimes I think we all have to be reminded of that.
So how do you coach people? How do you counsel people as a life coach, as a psychiatrist, to accept failure or accept limitations to their dreams after they have tried?
Well, again, I mean, I think when you, anytime something happens in your life, and you always have a perspective, and most of us learn the most when we're disappointed or when we have failed. So the key is to examine what happened, to pay attention to your emotions, pay attention to your feelings, and see if you can anticipate, readjust, work harder, work differently, so that the next time, and invariably, unfortunately, we get other chances to work things out, that you're prepared the second time around.
Let's hear some stories. Deborah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was always going to be the great artist, and I became a graphic designer after doing photography. And then in 2004, my father died. I inherited a building, and I became a landlady. And in the same time, print was dying, which is what I did. So I thought, well, if I can run this building, I can have the time to do my own work. And it was kind of the hardest thing I ever did. It was swimming with sharks. It still can be swimming with sharks. It's not anything that I knew. It was the school of hard knocks. But I'm really happy, and I'm able to do my own work, which has nothing to do with graphic design or photography. It's ceramics, and actually, it's all related because it's all art. But anyway, I was hoping to be like a famous Massimo Vignelli-like kind of person, and it never happened, but it's okay.
Did you have to
really okay.
Did you have to find a different part of your soul, sort of, in order to get fulfilled as a landlord when you thought you were going to be the big graphic designer?
Yeah, I had to get really tough, and that was really, really hard for me. I had to really, like, not be nice, not defer, not, you know, and it was, like, without... You know, it was really hard. It was really hard, and it was so concrete. And my father had always said, "You're not tough enough," and I never knew what he meant, and now I do.
Deborah, thanks a lot. Great,
yeah,
great story,
like
Janet.
It sounds like what Deborah did was she went in knowing that she had to make room for that creative side of herself. And although it didn't turn out that, you know, she did ceramics instead of something else, I think being mindful about that part of you as you enter in, whether it's a job or whether it's even different passions, is so important to keep track of.
Anne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Tell us your story.
Well, I'm 60, and when I was 24, I began to pursue a career as a performing artist. My contribution to this conversation is that, like so many, I taught for many years. Actually, I've been teaching for last 16 years. You know, who teaches boys, who teaches acting, who teaches dance. I was teaching dance. This year I gave it up. I said, that's it, no more. Because at this age, I didn't become depressed to be 60 in January. But I did realize that, you know, it's time to stop doing the things that I thought were going to be just for now, temporary, just until blah, blah, blah. I realized that until is not coming, and that I should stop doing the things that I really don't want to do now, now or never. And luckily, I also didn't make much money at it because I happened to teach tap dance. That's like the worst thing to try to teach in the world, but especially in Italy where I went. But luckily, I did discover, out of desperation, I discovered busking. So I sort of have realized that, you know, performing artists try constantly to define themselves. What the heck are you? Are you a dancer? I have decided at 60, and it's sticking, this thought. I am an entertainer, and I have decided to devote myself to busking because that has really worked for me, and I've had to give up. Well, I'm glad to give up a lot of the other things that I tried to do. It just wasn't me that I was trying to join tribes that I'm not that tribe.
How much did you struggle with teaching? I'm thinking of an old movie called The Competition, which is about concert pianists. And the one who wasn't going to make it or was going to give it up for family life or something like that had kind of this vision where he saw somebody who was getting by making it as a piano teacher of little kids, and the way the film depicted it, it was the dreariest possible existence to go from concert pianist to piano teacher of children. And so do you struggle with that? You know, the old cliche, the mean cliche, those who can't do teach. Did you struggle with that, and were you able to find peace with it as a teacher?
You know, I discovered this is just me because I have a lot of colleagues who teach. I realized that I want to study. I don't want to teach.
Yeah. You want to learn.
I wanted to study it. I want to learn. And teaching did not give me any time to learn.
Uh-huh.
And I also realized that, it was really, I taught for 16 years, and it's really dreary teaching the same things over and over, especially for a dancer, the same movements over and over. I mean, it's so counter-creative.
And thank you very much for your call. Janet Taylor, that raises some difficult realities, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But, you know, Dr. Laura Carstensen at Stanford writes about how aging reminds us that we don't have all the time in the world left to get it right and to get it right. And it sounds like Anne, your last caller, said she knew until wasn't coming and she was going to make decisions that were right for her.
Our family meeting on Making It on the Brian Lehrer Show right now, talking with people who are 50-plus on how you adjusted or not to the limits of your dreams as they were presenting themselves in your lives. John in Paramus, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Yes, Brian. I had a business for 22 years, and it was very successful, and I would have liked to have kept it going, but in the last few years, the economic conditions forced me to sell it. But, you know, I concentrate on the positive things I did for my business and the people who worked for me. I provided a salary for people. I provided jobs for people for 22 years. I never missed a payroll. And I provided great service. I may not have been the number one in the industry in my area or anything else like that, but I concentrate on that stuff. But I didn't go out on my own terms, but I concentrated on the stuff that I did well, like providing a service and providing employment for people for 22 years.
Thank you very much, John. So, when you start making those compromises, your dreams for a little improvement on reality, as we've heard from a couple of folks, how do you adjust? Did anyone see the movie Up in the Air and this scene where George Clooney lays off a guy?
Your resume says that you minored in French culinary arts. Most students there were going to fry at KFC, but you bust tables at Il Picador to support yourself. And then you get out of college and you come and you work here. How much did they first pay you to give up on your dreams?
$27,000 a year.
And when were you going to stop and come back and do what makes you happy?
Good question.
I see guys who work at the same company for their entire lives, guys exactly like you. They clock in, they clock out, and they never have a moment of happiness. You have an opportunity here, Bob. This is a rebirth. Now, if not for you, do it for your children.
How about that line, Janet Taylor? How much did they pay you to give up on your dreams?
I love that. I love that. And I also like the fact that you said this is a rebirth. And I think the point is, you know, we put so much focus on happiness, but a sense of purpose and finding your passion and dreams trumps happiness all the time. But it's up to you individually to figure it out.
Judy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. Sorry, I had to get you off speaker.
Sure.
I'm a violist, and I play in the New York Philharmonic, which certainly if you had told me in my childhood when I was a lousy violinist that I would reach that level, I would have never believed you. And what I found was that there is no time when you're going up the rung of achieving more and more professionally. There's no time when it's enough. You get to a certain point and you think, oh, that's really great, and a couple of days later it's not enough. And I realized, thanks to breaking both my arms a few years ago in a mountaineering accident.
Whoa.
And coming very close to losing my career.
A violist with two broken arms.
Yeah, it was not good. I'm actually, the reason I'm home is because my left arm is in a cast after yet another surgical procedure. To try to regain the range of motion that one needs to do the unnatural act of playing the viola. And in a way, this has been, in a weird way, a blessing, because it has kind of put full stop to that incessant craving for more. And, I mean, of course, it's not full stop. Of course, I want to do anything that anybody else is doing, I want to do better. And
but did it change not just what you thought you could do as a violist, at least in the short term, but change your outlook on life?
It did. It really did. I'm just happy to be able to play. I'm happier than I've ever been with my job at the Philharmonic. it has its shortcomings. In the dressing room, we're always complaining, and then we say, shut up, you're effing lucky to have this job. In fact, we have effing lucky parties on tours sometimes. But
and you never want your boss to say that, right? No, you don't want the conductor to come out and say,
right,
you're effing lucky to have this job.
Right.
Just remember you're one of, 100 people in the orchestra.
Right. No, fortunately, the conductor is tactful enough not to say that. He also knows that that would be a very unwise thing to do.
Yeah.
But he's lucky to have us. But it really... it's more comfortable now.
Did you ever find that your ambition to do more, better, faster got in the way of your love of the music?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you are thinking in terms of perfection is satisfactory and everything else is not satisfactory, it takes away from that just being in the music. If you're... I mean, ideally, you work as hard as you can technically, and then when you perform, you just let yourself go and you're there in the music. But
and yet, if you're going to make it as a violist at the level of the New York Philharmonic, and I know a lot of people in conservatory and people in your world, you have to be striving for perfection, like from the time you're six.
You do. Actually, for me, it was 10. But you do have to be striving for perfection, but... you know, it's there comes into play a sort of a Zen thing where you have to be non-attached. And it is really easy to say and really hard to do because very, very few people are going to play perfectly. I mean, there are a few rarefied individuals in solo careers who occasionally play unbelievably, you know, you could say flawlessly. But that's not for most of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you spend all your time, perfection is basically looking at the warts.
And I guess even for you as a violist, the pinnacle of what a musician could hope to attain on one level playing with the New York Philharmonic, the way you broke your arm says something about you because you went out on your free time and tried to climb mountains.
Well, I've done that since I was 20, and I love it. But, my mantra is now that I can't fall down anymore.
Judy, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Great call. And Jay in Hillsdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jay.
I'm good. Love your show.
Thank you.
For me, it's just I'm at a time where I'm, trying to work out a second act in my life, and I'm thinking about, I'm living with so much regret. It's so distracting. It distracts me during the day. It distracts me at night. And I'm remembering things that I had buried for so long. When I was in high school, the administrators exchanged my SAT scores with another student, and they had tried to sort of help me. They obtained a presidential scholarship for me, and they tried to help me with, achieve my goal of going to an Ivy League school, but it didn't work out, and I ended up going to a state school. And now I'm sort of, I had session for a while, and now I'm doing something else. And I'm thinking back, and it's causing such a distraction for me. I'm not present with my family.
Because you're thinking about what might have been that isn't going
right.
to happen. Andrea Taylor, as a life coach, as a community psychiatrist in New York City, talk to Jay.
Well, I mean, Jay, it sounds like, you may have some guilt but that you need to deal with, and that kind of distinguishes needing a life coach, somebody to move you forward, versus maybe even therapy to help deal with whatever is holding you back so that you can move forward to what you want. I mean, I went to a state school too. It's not, that may not be the issue, but the fact is there's something in Life Reimagined called repacking, which means what do you need to let go of to move forward? And if you're distracted and not present for your family and feeling unfulfilled, it sounds like there's a lot that you need to deal with so that you can accept where you are and maximize every single day of the rest of your life. I mean, you still have time to achieve something that you'd like to, but if you're going to hold back and be stuck, then you're just spinning your wheels.
Yes, I agree. I do. I would like to, to do something, despite, you know, the things that I, what's happened in my life. And I would like to not think about these things. I've actually buried them for so long, and now it's sort of coming to the fore. And I'm thinking about them over and over again. I'm like,
here's a suggestion. Write down everything that keeps coming up for you, everything that you did, every feeling that you had, and literally write it down on a piece of paper, do a ritual, truly bury it somewhere, and move on.
Well, that's what my wife suggests that I do. I have been writing it down.
But write it down and have a ritual and get rid of it. You mentioned the word bury it.
What's a ritual?
Burn it. Let it go, and figure out what's next.
What
for
kind
you.
Of ritual? Make up a ritual for us, Janet.
For me?
Yeah.
So you know, if you've written it down, get a clean piece of paper, write it down, use your favorite saying, and go out and actually, you know, I don't know if you want to burn a candle, if you just want to make it simpler, and bury it and say, from this day forward, I will no longer think about things that I did unless they make me better, and I'm going to move forward to and have two other things that you're going to work on. And not just say in your head, but, you know, if your goal is to, I don't know, be a better guitar player, if you do that, you're going to do that and take some lessons. So you identify a goal, have an action plan. But the whole point is to move forward and truly let go of what's holding you back. Because what's holding you back is yourself, period.
As they say in Frozen, let it go. But easier said than done. Jay, good luck. You know, I'm just thinking about the way he framed that, in part, about trying to aspire to an Ivy League school early on and having to settle for a state school is emblematic of something. I went to a state school, too, by the way. But... But I'm thinking of this in terms of class. I know you've been at Harlem Hospital. You're here in New York.
Right.
You see the very rich around you, and you see the people who will never be rich and never had that expectation. Do you think growing up in poverty makes people view success in certain ways, like more materialistic or less materialistic? I'm thinking, for example, of people who are or maybe used to be labeled nouveau riche, you know, come from nothing and make it into money, maybe being more likely to flaunt it with fancy cars, fancy bling, whatever, more than people who might have grown up having more than most. Do you know what I'm getting at?
I do, but my experience has been that when you are in poverty, your focus is on survival.
Yeah.
And that survival takes on many different meanings. And not only do people around you have less expectation, but resources, schools, jobs, other institutions have less expectations for you too. And I have never met a poor person who did not want to do better. Have never met one. But it's a matter of opportunity. It's a matter of resources. It's a matter of someone saying, you can do this. And I think that is the irony about what happens to people who do not have resources. On the flip side, I mean, I raised my girls in Westchester and have been exposed in numerous ways to people who definitely have more means and sometimes may not have the motivation because things come too easily. So, you know, it's about this ratio of success to expectation and then the preparation in terms of for people who have limited means, education basically is the only way. But I think we have to lose this notion as a society that people who live in poverty are not motivated and don't have any expectations because they do, but it really is a matter of resources and people expecting more of them.
Janet Taylor, community psychiatrist in New York City, life coach and a contributor to the AARP's Life Reimagined Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is. It's our family meeting on Making It on The Brian Lehrer Show. And if you can make it here or there, as Beyonce put it, you can make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York, New York. So for our final chapter, let's take some calls. And we're going to clear the board of everybody who is waiting for Janet Taylor, because we're changing topics here. Calls from anyone who moved to New York to make it at something, at anything. You know who you are. What does making it in New York mean compared to making it where you came from? 212-433-WNYC. And I would love to get some immigrants from other countries. Let's save some lines for immigrants from other countries. Immigrants, you know, we're always opening up the phones for you in our immigrants from anywhere call-ins. This is one of them. Immigrants from other countries and some immigrants from elsewhere in the United States. Let's see if we can get some of each of you on the board for our last few minutes here. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you came from India or if you came from Iowa, you get the meaning. How do you define making it in New York compared to making it in your country of origin? 212-433-WNYC, or how compared to making it in your state or city or small town of origin? 212-433-WNYC. If you're an immigrant to New York from another country or elsewhere in the United States, call up and compare what making it means to you here compared to where you came from. 212-433-9692. And we'll take your calls right after this.
Look at all the people.
How many of you came to New York like those characters from A Chorus Line? What does it mean to make it in New York compared to wherever you came from? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Nancy in Forest Hills, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, thank you. I came from a faraway country, New Jersey, and I came to be an actress, which I did for several years when I was in my 20s. And then I met my husband, and he's a jazz saxophonist, and I became a jazz singer. And now I'm a music teacher, and I love teaching.
Thank you very much. You're kind of putting a full circle point on one of the previous callers, right? Thank you very much. Emily in Cranford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Emily.
Yeah, hi. I'm just calling. Well, first I wanted to say I love your show.
Thank you.
And I'm originally from Minnesota, and my husband's French, and we were living in France, and we decided we wanted to come to the U.S., and he was able to find a job in New York City, probably after just a month of looking.
So what did making it in New York mean to you when you were in France, and to your husband who came from France? Was there an idea that you had in your head of what making it in New York meant, and was that different from making it in France?
Well, I knew, like, if I was going to be looking for a job in France, even knowing French, it would have been really difficult. And I think making it in New York, it's possible to do. You can come from many different places, and you can find a job, and you can do it, where I think it's a lot harder to go the other way in other countries, because people just accept you more here.
People accept difference here and ambition in a different way and just being an immigrant?
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, I never would have ever found a job, even speaking French, like I said, in a company in France, because the society is just more closed.
Right. And here people say, oh, you're from France. Cool.
Right.
Emily, thank you very much. Amari, originally from Ghana. Amari, thank you for calling in. You're on WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. So what was the idea of making it there compared to making it here?
Oh, well, I think it's an issue of personal orientation, your objective of coming to New York vis-a-vis staying in your home country. As on a personal note, I came here for education. So once I'm done with education, I feel like I've made it in New York.
Did you finish your education already?
I'm still pursuing my PhD. I'm about to start my dissertation.
That's great. In what?
In international business.
Uh-huh. And so with that background, coming from Ghana and coming here to work on education and get a PhD in international business, when you hear all these people who are calling in as if they're right out of a chorus line and they wanted to be dancers and musicians and artists, you feel that's like from a different world?
No, it's an issue of what you think and what do you want to do in life. We all have our expectations. We all have levels that we want to get to. And for as long as you have a way to get to what level, I think you feel satisfied. And I don't see any difference about people wanting to dance and stuff. That is what they want to do. I feel differently, and that's, I feel my way of being successful is getting a certain level of education, and that's what I'm pursuing.
Amari, thank you very much, and good luck at it. And Elsa in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Hi, Elsa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Milan, Italy, and I moved here about 2 years ago with a job offer, and it was like a dream come true for anyone who dreams to make it in the big city. Just wanted to say that what made it different from making it here, I didn't even think I made it, but the different thing is that the only person you can rely on here in New York is yourself.
Mm.
And that's a tough lesson I learned. And it's obviously harder and tougher compared to making it in Milan, where you have your family, your friends, people are close to you, you belong somewhere. Here it's hard because you have no roots and you're just fighting for yourself.
Do you think the notion of what it means to make it is different in the community? I don't mean to define all of Milan or all of Italy this way, but in the community that you came from than among people you know here in New York?
I'm not sure. I think there are a lot of similarities. I mean, I feel like nowadays with globalization and especially my field, graphic design and illustration, you sort of have to be out there to be recognized as someone who made it in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't feel like there's a lot of differences like that. But if anything, when you move to a city like New York, you sort of have to rely on all you got, and sometimes is enough, and sometimes it's not enough.
I hear you.
Thing that is lacking here, so for me, for instance, is the support from your important people.
Elsa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Obviously, you give up community in many cases to move to New York as an individual striver. And Lola in Scarsdale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lola.
This is Lola. Thank you very much, and I love your show.
Thank you.
I came from the Philippines, and I started as a babysitter when I came to New York, although I was a retired employee in the Philippines in the telecommunications company as a manager. Now, at present, I'm working with the Tanners here in Scarsdale, and I'm so happy that my children were able to finish their studies. My daughter is now a lawyer, and my son is now a financial analyst
at the
New Zealand Bank.
I know you. I met you recently, didn't I?
Yeah, and that was the foundation here.
But you're talking about moving from life as a professional in the Philippines to life as a household worker in the United States. So there's very different. You've adjusted or changed, or you had a certain definition of success.
Yeah, because when I came here, I'm already more than 60 years old, and I was thinking that I cannot work anymore in the office because I'm too old. So, and I still want to earn some money. So what I did is just I started as a babysitter, and now I'm working for the Tanners.
Yeah. Lola, thank you very much, and good luck to you. And Elizabeth on Long Island. You're on WNYC. Elizabeth, where are you from originally?
I am from West Virginia originally. Hi, Brian. I love your show.
Thank you.
It's been great listening to you. I wanted to just let you know that my husband and I moved to Long Island about 2.5 years ago so I could pursue my graduate degree in genetic counseling at Long Island University. And some of our clinical training that's required is in some of the most renowned hospitals in New York and on Long Island.
And so what's, because we only have 30 seconds left in the show, so what's making it here for you compared to Virginia, West Virginia?
The ability to provide patient care to such a diverse and amazing population, and also get the training from some of the most incredible doctors and physicians in the world. This is the place for medicine, and being trained here has made my education and my experience just absolutely amazing.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. You get the last word, and that's our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Making It. I just want to be, I just want to be successful. I just want to be, I just want to be successful. I just want to be, I just want to be successful. I want the money, money, money. I want a whole lot of that. Cause all the honeys, they asking where the dollars at. Where your head at? Tell me about the scholar cap. Trying to find a way, but you never got a map. Dream chaser, risk taker, no favor, though haters. They might want me to drown, hold it.